Welcome to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. As wildfires raged across Oregon, about 2,600 prisoners were evacuated from four prisons. Prisoners and family members reported that conditions were unsafe, unsanitary, and alarming. Some called the evacuations inhumane. As the Oregon Department of Corrections struggles to contain COVID-19 in the state's 14 prisons, there is concern that the chaotic evacuation during the wildfires endangered the health of prisoners and that further spread of COVID-19 is inevitable. My guests are Catherine Edwards and Tara Harivel, both Oregon attorneys. Catherine Edwards practices in poverty-related issues and civil rights. Tara Harivel is a prisoner's rights lawyer and practices in habeas corpus, post-conviction, and federal and state public defense. Tara, Kate, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Tara, so there are 14 state prisons across Oregon. Which prisons were evacuated due to the wildfires?
There were three prisons that were in the Valley, the Willamette Valley, Salem area: Oregon State Correctional Institution, Santiam Correctional Institution, Mill Creek Correctional Facility, with a population total of about 1,400 who were transferred to nearby, also Salem Prison, and the oldest maximum security prison in the state, Oregon State Penitentiary, where they were all housed together, various custody levels. And then there were women, plus staff were evacuated from the women's prison in Washington County, Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, to Deer Ridge Correctional Institution, which is in Madras and is a men's prison. So they were taken across the state.
So how did you learn about the evacuations, Kate?
Yeah, I heard from several clients from Coffee Creek. Initially, the Salem area prisons were evacuated first, and I found out through the media, actually, that they had been evacuated, or that the Coffee Creek prison, my clients contacted me, several of them, on the day of, I believe it was September 10th. I was getting just rapid-fire phone calls from clients and messages from family members who'd received frantic calls from clients because the prison was filling with smoke, and they were finding it really hard to breathe and weren't getting any information from the staff there. And it was a few hours of just complete confusion, reaching out to the Department of Justice and reaching out to representatives within the Department of Corrections and trying to find out what was happening. And I eventually found out through clients who heard from corrections officers and other prisoners that they were going to be transferred to Deer Ridge Correctional Institution, but it wasn't actually confirmed until, I think it wasn't until the next day that it was actually confirmed for us, and they were well on their way there.
And Tara, how did you learn about the evacuations?
The same way. Our clients were blowing up our phones, telling us the smoke is filling in the prison, and we don't know what's happening, and we can't breathe, and those who have asthma are having hacking attacks, and they were really terrified.
So what did your clients tell you about the evacuations? What happened?
The stories came out after, when they could access funds. And they were calling really for a full day straight, everybody that they could on our team. And we have about 25 attorneys and 190 clients across the state. And a good majority of those are women from Coffee Creek. They were blowing up our phones. And then they went completely silent around the evening of the 10th. And then we started hearing from them again within the next couple days. And what happened was Oregon Department of Corrections transferred them beginning around 11 p.m. the night of the 10th, September 10th, in buses, which we learned later were not staffed by regular Department of Corrections drivers, but middle school bus drivers. And they zip-tied our clients together for no particular reason except that they wanted to control their bodies, and took about 10 or 11 buses across the state, which took about 4 hours, did not let them eat or drink, did not give them their medications for about 24 hours. It would ultimately be once they arrived at Deer Ridge in Madras, they stayed in the buses for another 2 to 3 hours. They were instructed to, if they needed to urinate or if they needed to use the bathroom or vomit in any way, to do it in a sock, to throw tampons out the window. And they eventually got inside the building, which was not prepared for them at all. There were metal beds no mattresses, no food, and no medication until the next day at about 1 or 2 in the afternoon. And huge fights were reported breaking out over the next few days. It was a complete chaotic and incredibly dangerous environment.
And Kate, what did your clients tell you?
Much the same thing that Tara describes. My clients described complete fear. They didn't know where they were going. They didn't know how long they were going to be on the bus. The air quality was terrible. And so they were left to sit on the bus. I mean, for the whole ride, they had the windows open in the terrible air quality. So many of them with breathing problems and health problems, many of them medically vulnerable and elderly, were left there to breathe this air. And they didn't know how long they were going to be contained on the bus. I also heard that because they did not administer medications properly, for some women, as long as 24 hours, and at least one person had a seizure. She hadn't been provided her seizure medication and had a seizure. And because the staff was since they were so understaffed and outnumbered, it took them 7 minutes to respond and actually get her medical attention while she seized on the floor. I also heard reports from my clients that people who are diabetic were getting ill from not having access to food or not getting their insulin and medication. So it was incredibly dangerous to their health and their well-being. The guards were completely outnumbered. One client in particular expressed that many people were afraid because the guards were so outnumbered by the inmates, and they'd mixed the inmates without regard to minimum or medium security. And so it was really a problem waiting to happen to have so many people mixed together, angry, confused, hungry, tired, and for the guards to be so outnumbered. And my clients expressed that they had a real fear of that.
So the men from 3 minimum and medium security prisons were evacuated to Oregon State Penitentiary, which is a maximum security prison. So what kind of issues did that create?
It was a madhouse. Every client I've spoken with said there were massive fights. People were getting extremely hurt. There were prisoners who were attacked by other prisoners. There were gangs, roving gangs of maximum security OSP folks attacking the incoming folks. We've heard stories of prisoners standing on tiers and throwing bombs at the prisoners below, filled with feces, vomit, and blood. We've heard many stories about Band-Aids, bloody Band-Aids showing up in food. We keep hearing that one over and over again. And when we hear these stories, you know, they're from people who are independently telling us, reporting what happened, who have no way to know who's talking to us, no way to, you know, make their stories consistent if they even would. The veracity is pretty clear when you've got, you know, 10 people telling you the same thing who are coming from different prisons in the same place at the same time. Again, the staff were totally overwhelmed, so they were relying on chemical weapons and pepper spraying excessively because there weren't enough people and they were panicked, which added to the chaos.
And to the air quality.
That's right. And they don't have a central air system at OSP, so they have the windows open in the middle of all of this. And it's completely incomprehensible why they moved 3 prisons, like within 5 miles. I think they're all within 5 miles of each other. Into the same area. Department of Corrections was apparently completely panicking and making decisions on the fly that were really poor decisions. They weren't protecting anyone. They were putting them in a much worse environment in the same area.
Kate, what did your clients say? What was happening at the Oregon State Penitentiary when they were evacuated to that prison?
I have clients both who were evacuated to Oregon State Penitentiary, and I also have some clients that are housed at Oregon State Penitentiary. So I heard reports kind of from both sides. From the people who are housed at Oregon State Penitentiary, OSP, I heard that the Department of Corrections brought in all of these evacuees, but didn't really tell the prisoners housed there what was going on, just locked them down. And so they were locked down for about a day and a half. And it was very similar to what happened at Coffee Creek. They weren't getting access to food or medicine. In the case of some people, they didn't get their medication for 24 hours. One of my clients reported that he and several others, the first day they didn't have any meds. On the second day, they only got half doses for some reason. And on the second day, nobody in their unit was fed on anything resembling normal timelines. They couldn't leave their cells to go to the chow hall, so food was supposed to be brought to them. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, no one had received breakfast yet. And at 10 o'clock at night, there were still some people that hadn't received breakfast. All of my clients who are housed at OSP reported similar conditions. Now, for the clients who were evacuated to the facility, I've just heard horror stories about the violence and the fear. One client in particular was supposed to be kept separate from another prisoner who had previously, in the past, sexually and physically assaulted him. And DOC had a written order that said that they were supposed to be kept separate for my client's safety. And once everyone got off the bus at OSP, all those orders sort of went by the wayside. And all of the prisoners had to sit on the yard at OSP once they got off the bus for the whole day out in the terrible air quality. They sat outside into the morning hour. Some of them sat there until 2 a.m. waiting to be processed to be allowed into the facility. And my client, it was only a matter of a couple of hours before his attacker found him. And my client was physically and sexually assaulted twice during the course of being at OSP. It sounds like there were also not enough guards, not enough staff around, because these attacks just went unnoticed.
And I understand the women actually protested at one point.
The reports that I received from clients were that the women, they refused to go back to their cells because they hadn't had any food. It was the middle of the day. They hadn't had any food. They weren't being allowed to take showers. When they had evacuated, some of them were told to bring towels and shower shoes and a change of clothes, but other women weren't told that. They didn't know what they were doing or where they were going. And so some of them didn't bring clean clothes or towels. And so they refused to bunk in. And I've received reports that they were breaking chairs and overturning tables. I haven't received any reports that anyone was hurt or that there was any physical violence perpetrated toward any people, but that the guards were very out of their element in trying to contain the issue. But it sounds like it worked, because very soon after the women protested, they returned to their bunks and then they were actually fed and they were provided, you know, shower shoes and towels.
So is this the official report from Oregon Department of Corrections that things went so terribly wrong, Tara?
No, the official report so far is we did the best we could with what we had. We had to save women and men from the fires and put COVID to the side, make decisions about what we could do with what we had, but nobody got hurt. Those are basically the words from Colette Peters, who is the ODOC director.
Tara, Kate, you both are involved with a team of attorneys who are currently bringing 180 cases against the Oregon Department of Corrections for failure to protect prisoners from COVID-19. So how does this botched evacuation exacerbate COVID-19 in the prisons?
Well, it literally created an outbreak currently at Coffee Creek as a result of the total and complete failure to take any precautions during the evacuation. I should note also, we actually have 212 cases today. It just increases exponentially every week and will continue to as long as we still have this outbreak and a failure to protect by the Department of Corrections and a failure to implement social distancing by Governor Brown in the prisons by releasing a substantial number of people, which is what it would take. So the evacuations in specifics involved procedures that were emergency and not clearly intended to provide any protection from COVID while implemented, including zip tying wrists of women together on the buses in small buses that transported them for hours across the state in a congregate environment, and commingling once women who were transferred from Coffee Creek to the men's prison at Deer Ridge and Madras remained commingling. And all reports from that particular evacuation were that there were no masks to be seen, used by any staff, and no PPEs provided and no precautions taken when they were there at all regarding COVID. So since the evacuation that occurred the evening of 9/10 into the early hours of 9/11, a major outbreak of COVID is now spreading across the women's prison upon their return.
Additionally, I think that it affected the COVID outbreak because when people were evacuated to the prisons, especially when the women went to Deer Ridge and the facility wasn't capable of handling them, it wasn't prepared for all of those additional people. And so they ran out of basic things like hand soap almost the entire time that the women were there. They had no hand soap. And so they had to just, you know, rinse their hands with water every time they went to the bathroom, which is not sanitary in normal conditions. But when you have a serious outbreak of a deadly illness, that is seriously increasing the likelihood of that happening.
I'm hearing that they are not taking precautions recommended by CDC, such as the security guards not wearing masks.
The correctional officers, as they call themselves, they are not using masks consistently at this point. They didn't apparently use masks much at all during the evacuation, which led to the current outbreak at Coffee Creek. And I should note, three prisons are filled with the populations of men were also evacuated and placed in an intermingled environment with no precautions also at Oregon State Penitentiary. And so we just don't know the extent of the outbreak, but there will be one from those prisons as well, most likely. But there wasn't even a mandate for prison staff or contractors to wear masks at all until we, with the group of attorneys raising these cases, these COVID cases, did some advocacy to the governor's office in June and July. And it led eventually to Department of Corrections requiring masks for the first time, starting as late as August 13th. Until then, from the point that we knew that there was a widespread pandemic around April, March to August 13th, there was no requirement that prison staff, who are the vectors for bringing the virus in and out, as we know, even wear masks. So now there has been quite a bit of pushback since the mandate, and even the Guards Union, for reasons that aren't entirely known, is pushing back on being required to wear masks. So they still are not being 100% consistent, according to our clients, pretty much across the board. The worst example of refusal to wear masks, most egregious in terms of its incredible risk, that we have heard repeatedly and consistently from multiple different people in multiple different prisons, are medical staff who are not following the very clear mandate that they must wear PPEs, N95 type masks and gloves when having any interaction with a prisoner. And we have heard just many reports that when people pick up meds on the med line, nurses are not wearing masks or gloves. We have heard many reports that nurses are checking with ungloved hands the inside of prisoners' mouths for cheeking of medications or hiding medications, and then using that same hand on the next prisoner in the med line to check for cheeking. There couldn't be a more effective way to spread this virus, and these are the kinds of things going on in our prisons.
Kate, were the prisoners, as they were returning to their prisons after being evacuated, were they being tested upon entry into the prison?
Not immediately, no. We received reports that the prison staff started offering COVID tests about a week and a half to 2 weeks after they returned. And that's a start, that they started offering these tests to everyone who wanted them, because they had previously said that it was not feasible to test everyone, but they did start offering these tests, but it was very much too little too late, because by that time, the outbreak had spread to many women. And by a week and a half to 2 weeks after they'd been back, there's no telling how many people they exposed.
And what happens when they do test positive? Is there an area where they're being quarantined in the prison?
In some prisons, they're actually put into the disciplinary segregation unit, or the hole, as they colloquially call it. And in some places, they're just locked into a specific cell area. But
the consistent thing is that when they're quarantined, when they test positive, they're quarantined in isolation. And whether they're actually in the disciplinary segregation unit, the whole or not, they receive quite punitive measures. They get most of their privileges taken. I'm hearing reports right now from clients who are currently being quarantined, who are on lockdown 23 and a half hours a day. One client said that every day she gets a half an hour out of her cell and she has to choose between calling her husband and kids or showering. The DOC keeps telling us that these are not punitive measures, but it appears very punitive, and it is a big deterrent for the women in both consenting to testing now that they're actually doing testing and coming forward when they actually have symptoms.
And Tara, can you talk about the cases that you and other attorneys are bringing against the Oregon Department of Corrections?
Sure. This is a unique and pretty rare legal tool called the habeas corpus, and it means release the body. It predates the Constitution and is first found in the Magna Carta. So this is a really ancient tool, legal tool, and it's to release people from prison or confinement in any kind of jail or prison setting where there's unlawful conditions. And so we have in Oregon a robust court appointment system for indigent prisoners to access this tool when they file their pro se petitions for habeas corpus, arguing that they have usually conditions of confinement in prisons or jail that involve inadequate medical care. And so I practiced this area of law for a while, and we created this project when the pandemic arose, thinking this would be a tool for one remedy for prisoners, and it's ended up being like the tool for all Oregon prisoners that they can access. And there's not much else for most. So it is bringing a claim that is constitutional in nature against the Department of Corrections for failure to, in the context of COVID, protect them from contracting or spreading COVID due to inadequate precautions and noncompliance with the guidelines for jails and prisons under the Centers for Disease Control guidelines. And then there's also separate, sometimes separate medical claims for failure to provide adequate treatment. And we have a team of attorneys of about 25 or 26 attorneys at this point across the state, bringing these cases on behalf of individual prisoners and pretrial detainees in jail, asking the court to intervene since the Department of Corrections has so far failed to keep people safe from widespread outbreak and to comply as meaningfully and as fully as they could with the CDC guidelines.
The Oregon Department of Corrections is ill-equipped to handle COVID-19, let alone a second crisis. So what can be done moving forward?
Well, the governor has all the power, and she is the one who has the power to make the change. She could, and she should, make a substantial release plan for people who fit appropriate criteria, as they have in Washington State, as they have in California, where they released around 8,000 prisoners in order to implement social distancing. Now, California did it after about 1,000 people contracted COVID in San Quentin. We don't need to get to that point of a disaster, although we're headed straight to it. The governor is the only one who has the power to release people early. There are criteria that would be appropriate to consider, which she could consider and has considered on an extremely limited basis so far for only 57 people during this period. But she could consider releasing people who are already close to release, have nonviolent convictions, who have release plans in the community, and who have, you know, no record of conduct that would be unfavorable while incarcerated. So they are no threat to the community. And we have actually presented to the governor's office multiple times advocacy letters for early release for many of our clients who fit these criteria and had them summarily rejected. And she is the one who could ensure that, in fact, social distancing is even possible. It is not possible at this point. And the Department of Corrections, in fact, was tasked by her early phases of this pandemic in April to present her with a plan, what it would take to implement social distancing in Oregon prisons. And number one was 40% reduction in the prison population of people who are medically vulnerable. That was the top criteria. You know, we have over 14,000 prisoners, so it'd be a substantial amount of prisoners being released, around 6,000. And to stop putting people in prison. And she rejected those very clear guidelines, which were the only way to implement social distancing, and has come up with no plan in the alternative, and has rejected our attempts, at least, to present to her candidates who are medically vulnerable, close to release, have release plans, and we don't know why. She even recently made a public announcement a couple weeks ago or so that she asked the Department of Corrections to come to her with 400 people who fit the criteria I just noted. And then, for reasons that are not entirely clear, she reduced that to 88 people within a short time later. What I understand is that there wasn't enough housing. But we, at the same time in our group, presented her with people who had, at least 50 people who had housing options established. And that was rejected. So it's entirely unclear if there's any intention to provide any kind of real social distancing in prisons and protect all of these 14,000 plus people in Oregon prisons.
Kate, did you have any final words?
I have heard people express that they wonder why they should care about this issue, why they should care about prisoners and what they're experiencing, especially right now when so many people have experienced such loss. People have lost their houses, people have lost their lives. And anytime that there's an issue like this where prisoners are suffering, it is human nature to want to other those in our society who committed harms. And we have a very retribution-based criminal justice system. And there's a quote that I really like by Brené Brown, who's a researcher on human emotions. And it's that we don't have to rank people's experiences. We don't have to assign a hierarchy or ranking to the level of suffering that people experience, because empathy and compassion are infinite. And so there's enough to go around for everybody. It doesn't minimize or trivialize the loss that one group is experiencing to also acknowledge the loss and suffering that another group has experienced. And in this context, yes, my God, people have lost their lives. They've lost their homes, their loved ones. And that's horrible. But there are these people who have also suffered some real trauma and indignities as a result of these evacuations and as a result of COVID. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that suffering, because these are humans, and like it or not, they are part of our society, whether we other them or not. Our Constitution grants rights to people. It doesn't delineate or distinguish between people who should have their rights upheld and people who shouldn't. It only grants those rights. And it's incredibly important to uphold people's rights, especially under the Constitution, because if we allow one group's rights to be eroded, then that erodes the entire system. It erodes the entire Constitution and the very principle of having rights. So it's incredibly important to uphold everyone's, because otherwise, who gets to decide what group gets their rights upheld versus what group doesn't?
You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. Thank you to my guests, Oregon attorneys Catherine Edwards and Tara Haravel. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineers, and thank you for listening.